Chapter 18 had to do with the individual responsibilities for sin. And someone mentioned, by way of application, that, again, it is the soul that sins, it will die. You will not die for the sins of others, right? You die for your own sins. And the application I thought was helpful was that of should you suffer the consequences for your great-great-grandfather, for instance, right, being a slave owner? Yeah. Are you responsible for that? The answer is no, right? Regardless of what some in our culture would say. It's the soul that sins, it shall die, right? Now, chapter 19 goes to more of a political atmosphere, if you will. It's a funeral dirge, or if you prefer, a song of mourning, not of the mourning, but of mourning, okay? Like mourning doves, right? Not the mourning dove, but it's mourning, right, with a U. So this, and you can see here, this is the first of five laments in the book of Ezekiel. This is the only one for the nation of Israel. Tyre gets three of them, and Egypt gets one. It's also curious that Ezekiel does not use the title in this chapter of king. He calls them leaders, perhaps because they aren't really legitimately kings, sort of kings, pseudo kings, quasi kings. But there's no accidents, right, in these types of things. And it's there's a definite omission of that title king. One other thing I should mention before we get to Ezekiel 19, and that is Genesis chapter 49. And Genesis 49 is Jacob on the proverbial deathbed, and he is giving out his blessings or his prophecies, if you will, of his sons. And in chapter 49, beginning in verse 8, we have the tribe of Judah. And Judah, as for you, your brothers shall praise you. Now that's a play on words, right? Judah means praise, right? That's a Jew. The word Jew means praise, okay? The play on words there. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. In other words, you're going to rise in importance and influence. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He crouches, he lies down as a lion and as a lioness. Who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah. In other words, what? What tribe will the kings of Israel come from? From the tribe of Judah. Nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dark from wine and his teeth white from milk. Again, that imagery, I think, echoes in this chapter. And again, we need to remember that the people of Israel were much more familiar with Old Testament than what we are, so they would hear those echoes. Okay, they're listening for those repetitions, and I think that's what we see here. So when Ezekiel gives to us this illustration of the lion and the vine, okay, those are both found there in Genesis 49. So the imagery back in Ezekiel 19, the imagery of the lioness and her cubs in verses 1 and 2, as for you, take up a lamentation for the princes or the leaders of Israel and say, what was your mother? A lioness among lions. She lay down among young lions. She reared her cubs. So you say, well, that's not real earth-shattering, right? But obviously it's an illustration, right? What's it pointing to? And I've given you a couple of options here. One, we could take it literally and say this is a reference to Josiah's queen Hamathul from 2 Kings 24. That's possible. I would probably be inclined to go that direction. Others would say, no, it's a word picture, it's a metaphor, a figure of speech for the entire nation of Judah, the southern tribes. That's doable too, right? This is not something you want to fight over or argue about, because no one is ever going to, I don't think, come up with a 100% conclusive interpretation on it. It makes sense either way, I think. Now, the cubs probably refer to King Josiah's family, namely the last four kings of Judah. There were the brothers Jehoahaz and Zedekiah. There was Jehoiakim, their half-brother, and then Jehoiakim had a son with at least referred to by at least these three names: Jehoiakim, Jeconiah, and Coniah. So we like things to be a little easier as far as who's named what, but it's just, I was in Acts 15 studying for Family Bible Time down the road, and Peter's called Peter, and then when James gets up to explain things in chapter 15, he refers to Simeon. Well, Simeon hasn't talked yet, but actually he has, right? Because Simeon is Peter's Jewish name, okay? And James is very deliberate to use his Jewish name there, because it's the conservative Jews that are all upset, right? So he deliberately says Simeon. And the only other place that that name is used of Peter is in 2 Peter chapter 1. So names, it might not so much be the meaning of the name that's so important as it is what name, because there's a significance to that, and that's what we have here. Now, we do know that this lioness had some cubs. It says that. Now, in verses 3 and 4, the first cub, well, let's just read it. So she brought up one of her cubs, and he became a lion, which is, again, not earth-shaking. And he learned to tear his prey. He devoured men. Verse 4, then nations heard about him. He was captured in their pit, which, again, is oftentimes how they would do their hunting, was to dig a pit, throw some type of branches over it, and then lure the lion over, and then, you know, fall in. They brought him with hooks to the land of Egypt. Now, that is a literal thing. We know from archaeology, pictures of the various kings around the Middle East who had literally put hooks in the captive's nose, okay, and then tie a rope to them and then make sure they made it to wherever, to Egypt, to Babylon, to Assyria. So there is that. And I think of that every time I see somebody at a store with the nose rings. I'm sorry, but that's what I think. And I shouldn't do that, but that's what comes to my mind. So, so. But Jehoahaz was a cruel man, we know that. And I've given you the references there from 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. He reigned for an extremely long period of time of almost 90 days. Okay? Yeah. Then you have to vote again. No. But he was a cruel individual. Ezekiel's lion is not satisfied with ordinary prey. Daniel Block highlights, he devours men, right? he developed a particular appetite for human flesh. In other words, he was the violent man. Now, there's an interesting thing with Hebrew, and I know it's not used here, but the concept is used when the Hebrew word dam is used, it references blood. When you make it into a plural, and then it references violence. Okay. And it's the bloods, as it would be a quite literal translation, bloods is always in a negative sense in Scripture. And this is a man who is characterized by bloods. He's a man characterized by violence. Similar, I would argue, similar to David. Why was David not allowed to build a temple for God? Because he was what? He was a man of bloodshed. Now, that doesn't mean he was not allowed because he had killed somebody. Just, after all, Moses was a murderer, right? We know that. But it seems to be that David, and I think we see this throughout 1 Samuel, is that David enjoyed the shedding of blood. I remember when he was asked to come up with the dowry for his bride, and he went out and killed double the men, which would be obviously an indication of somebody who has a blood lust, right? Somebody who is bloodthirsty. So it's not, and I've talked with soldiers in the past who've been in bad situations, and they've killed the enemy, and they have thought, well, because I've killed somebody, therefore, no, that's not what it's referencing. It's not killing somebody in a legitimate manner. Okay? There are times when it is legit. It's the issue of enjoying the violence. Right? We're warned throughout Scripture to avoid the man of violence, lest you become like him. Right? Here we have a man who is a man of violence, and he ends up getting taken captive by Pharaoh Necho II. You can read that in 2 Kings 23 and in Jeremiah 22. So that seems to be who that is. That would fit, I think, quite well. The problem, I think, that is more of a struggle is this second cub in verses 5 through 9. And she saw as she waited that her hope was lost, and so she took another of her cubs and made him a young lion. Now, let me just stop there. Then she saw as she waited. Is that Queen Hamutal, or is that the entire nation? The entire nation does not make the king, right? Now, we may do that in America, so to speak, right? But in Israel, it was hereditary, more or less. Not always, but normally it was hereditary. So this, to me, would lead me to be inclined that this reference is to Josiah's wife. Okay, that she is behind the scenes getting her sons. Kind of reminds me of James and John's mother, right? Make sure my sons can sit, one in your right, one in your left. I think we have a similar thing. But this second cub is one of these three men, and I've given you references there. I've given you their how long they reigned in some of their circumstances. Jehoiakim, also known as Eliakim, reigned for 9 years. Jehoiakim reigned for 3 months before he was imprisoned by the Babylonians for 37 years. That's a long time to be in prison. Zedekiah reigns for 11 years and interacts with ambassadors from several countries. Let me back up to, I had stopped here, in verse 5. So begin, go back to verse 6. And he walked about among the lions. He became a young lion. He learned to tear his prey. He devoured men. He knew how to destroy their fortified towers and laid waste their cities. And the land was in desolation as well as its fullness because of the sound of his roaring. Then nations put themselves against him all around from their provinces. And they spread their net over him. He was captured in their pit. They put him in a cage with hooks and brought him to the king of Babylon. They brought him in hunting nets so that his voice would be heard no more on the mountains of Israel. So there are, again, I think there's good arguments for each of these men. Maybe what Ezekiel is doing is kind of lumping them all together in a certain way, that these are just additional sons or additional cubs of this woman. Again, at the same time, I don't think one can argue 100% absolutely we know which one of these this is. She is apparently the one who is getting her favorites into a position of leadership. So she is a manipulator, and her sons are not godly men. Right? You look at those last kings of Judah, and they're just almost as bad, if not worse, right, at times, than the leaders of the northern tribes. So, well, that leads us, if we can, to the next figure of speech, the next imagery, which is that of the vine. And again, we're familiar with that. This is Isaiah 5 illustration. But exactly what, again, what are we looking at here? First of all, in verses 10 and 11, your mother was like a vine in your vineyard. You can send your mom a Mother's Day card like that and see how that goes for you. But your mother was like a vine in your vineyard, planted by the waters. It was fruitful and full of branches because of abundant waters. Psalm 1 come to mind? Right? Being like a tree planted by the rivers of water and having abundant fruit. Jeremiah, is it 17? That has a similar illustration. The point is, it's well cared for. It has an ideal situation. And because of its ideal situation, again, we're not talking southern Minnesota swampland. Okay? You have to remember that. It is so easy for us to forget. We think, well, you plant something, of course it's going to grow, right? Because it always rains. And we have enough moisture. More often than not, we're fine as far as moisture. The land of Israel is not the case. If something is going to grow, it's going to take work. Okay? And if you're going to plant something, you're going to make sure that there's a source of water in some way that you're going to be able to water this plant. It's not easy. Now, it has an ideal situation. Somebody has really cared for this vine. In verse 11, and it had strong, thick branches fit for scepters of rulers. In other words, where were we recently? We were talking about the branch that was not even fit to use as a peg to hang your clothes on. Okay, here is a grapevine that is in such good condition that if you were to lop off one of the branches, you could put it on your lathe and turn out a really nice scepter for the king. Okay, it's an unusual, extremely unusual. And its height was exalted above the clouds. Hard to collect the grapes from up there. So that it was seen in its exaltedness with the mass of its foliage. Obviously, this is not a real thing, right? This is imagery. The point is, ideal situation, incredibly prosperous growth. And if we were to stop there, we'd say, wow, that's really encouraging. It's real pleasant. But Ezekiel's not done, right? Verse 12. Now comes destruction, 12, 13, and 14. But it was uprooted in wrath. It was cast down to the ground. So it doesn't matter how much water is over there. Okay? If the roots aren't in the ground, it's not going to do any good. Not only that, not only was it uprooted and thrown on the ground, and the east wind dried up its fruit, its strong, thick branch was torn off so that it dried up, and the fire consumed it. So, seems to be a reference to Babylon coming from the east, seems to be a reference to Jehoiakim being dried up and harmed, verse 13. So now it is planted in the wilderness, in a dry and thirsty land. Now again, there's not that Israel was necessarily that much better, but at least there had been some water. But now you're in Babylon. Now you're out in the middle of, before the oil fields came to be. Now you're out in all the sand. So it seems to be him being taken into Babylonian exile. And the fire has gone out from its thick branch. It has consumed its shoots and fruit so that there is not in it a strong, thick branch, a scepter to rule. This is a lamentation and has become a lamentation. So, seemingly a reference to the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians. And again, regardless of which king it is, which ruler it is, both of these lead us to, well, would lead the people of Israel to grief, right? The lion cubs have been captured. The vine has been uprooted and dried up and burned. Can't get any worse. So you've gone from this wonderful, idyllic situation of whether it's the mother, the lioness and her cubs, and we watch those on public television sometimes, and you go, oh, that's so cute, and oh, is that so great, and yeah, okay, and that's all fine, fine and cuddly type of a thing, and yet they grow up, right? And they become violent. And they suffer consequences. The vine in its idyllic circumstances. And what better preparation could have been made for this vine? Everything is just as it should be until the destruction. So Israel can look back at this, and they should be able to look back at this and say, we had it so good. God took care of us and provided for us. God has, and again, the illustration from Isaiah 5, God has planted us in the best possible location. God has put us here in the Middle East, in the land of Canaan, and he has put us there, the city of Jerusalem, known as the joy of the whole earth, right? Psalm 48. We couldn't have it any better. And what did we do with all that privilege? What did we do with all the things, all the grace that God poured out upon us? We threw it away, right? And that's these two, if you will, parables, or these two figures of speech would do for us. Now, as you think about what happens here, and this is my last point, letter C on your outline, and that is this, that Israel has had no king since this time. In 586, when when Jerusalem is finally destroyed, Israel has no king. From 586 BC until their king comes, and the what we refer to as Palm Sunday, right, his so-called triumphal entry. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, right? And within a week, they're calling for his destruction, right? And yet, we know that what happens in the gospel accounts, what is described for us in Acts 2 and in Acts 4, is not the end, right? There is the hope that their king is coming again. And this is what Israel has to come to grips with. When you go back to Psalm 2, let's just go ahead and do that real quick. As you think of the people of Israel, but also the people of the surrounding nations, the psalmist says, "Why do the nations rage and the peoples meditate on a vain thing?" You're going to meditate on something, right? That's why Psalm 1 and Psalm 2 go together as an introduction to the rest of the Psalms. What are you going to meditate on? The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers take counsel together against Yahweh and against his anointed, saying what? We don't want him to rule over us. Let us tear their fetters apart and cast their cords from us. In other words, the teaching of God is so cumbersome and so restrictive, and God is always telling me what to do. Well, yeah, actually he does. In love and infinite wisdom and infinite knowledge, right? But we don't, as people, as human beings, as unredeemed human beings, we don't want somebody telling us how to live. He who sits in the heavens laughs. And again, that's not because of a joke. It's a mocking laugh, right? The Lord, the sovereign one, mocks them. And then he speaks to them in his anger and terrifies them in his fury, saying, "But as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain." Now you may not like that, but he's my king. And I will put him where I want him to be, and he will. Now look at verse 7. "I will surely tell of the decree of Yahweh. He said to me," now this is the king speaking, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." Now again, we know from other cultures around the Middle East, when a king was placed on the throne, he was said to have been begotten. Doesn't mean he just came into existence at that point. He wasn't born yesterday, so to speak, but he was begotten. Okay? And that's what this is referencing. "Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as your inheritance and the ends of the earth as your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron." There's that concept of a scepter again. We talked about a scepter made of vine wood, grapevine wood. This is a scepter of iron. Now, what happens with that scepter or that rod of iron? "You shall shatter them like a potter's vessel." Okay, you got your piece of metal, and you go after a piece of pottery. Who's going to win? Right? That's the illustration that's used here. Now, the king is going to rule. The issue is, how are you going to respond to that? Are you going to look forward to that with joy, joyful anticipation, or are you going to look back or look forward to it with, "Ah." Oh, okay. Now, verse 10. "So now, O kings," show insight. If you're a king and you're running a nation, use your brain. Okay? In essence, is what the psalmist says. Show some insight. "And take warning, O judges of the earth." So grasp, right? Grasp what what has been said here. God is going to put his king on this earth and he will rule. What are you going to do about it? Well, verse 11 tells them what they should do. Serve Yahweh with fear. In other words, live in awe of God and what? Rejoice. Right? It's a wonderful thing that the king is coming. It's not something, king. No, the king is coming, right? And you can rejoice, but rejoice with trembling, right? There's that balance. So then what? Kiss the son. Now, that is, there's nothing romantic about this. There's nothing immoral about this. It was a kiss of submission. Now, sometimes you see it in some old depictions in different movies of kissing the ring. It was kissing the feet. You come and kiss the foot of the king. You show submission to the king. Okay? Submit to the king. Why? Lest he become angry and you perish in the way. Okay? Now, you're free to not kiss the son's feet. That's your choice. There's consequences. You will perish in the way if you don't. Why? For his wrath may soon be kindled. But again, the promise. What? How blessed. The multiplicity of blessings. How blessed are all. Not just some. But how blessed are all who take refuge in him. You say, well, I'm a king. I don't take refuge in anybody but myself. Well, that's your problem. Right? That's your problem. You need to submit to the king. And that is the very thing that what we just looked at in Ezekiel 19 is the last leaders of the southern tribes refused to kiss the son lest he become angry. And they did perish in the way. Right? It's already been given to them. And when they stood in the temple and they heard these songs sung, and when somebody picked Psalm 2 on open form and it was sung, they heard it, right? Every time. But what did they do with it? They refused. And so the lion cubs were captured and the vine was destroyed. Because they refused to follow the simplest of things at the very beginning of the book of Psalms. It's not like it's an obscure psalm. It's the second one, right? So you've heard it read, and if you were a king of Judah, what was your responsibility? Is to make a copy of, at least make your own handwritten copy, at least of the law, right? So you knew at least what the first five books of the Word of God said. But as you heard the psalms sung, as you heard them read, there's no excuse. You've heard Psalm 2 before. So we ought not be surprised. At the same time, it is still Ezekiel 19 is still a song of mourning. It's a lamentation. You grieve because here's people who've had an ideal situation. God has done everything for them. He has left nothing undone for them. Their preparation has been ideal. Their circumstances are just right. There are no excuses. But the problem is not their circumstances. The problem is not their situation. The problem is their heart. And they refuse to submit to the king, to kiss the son, lest he be angry with them. All right, I'm going to stop there.